In 2013, Volume 1 of Charles Moore's authorized biography of Margaret Thatcher was published to extraordinary reviews both here and in the UK. Now, Volume 2, Margaret Thatcher, at her zenith in London, Washington, and Moscow, continues Moore's examination of the Iron Lady. The book captures the period between 1982 and 1987 and focuses on Thatcher's re-election, her relationship with President Reagan, and her political and personal life at the height of her career. Charles Moore is the former editor of the Daily Telegraph and the Sunday Telegraph. He's been working on this project for over 15 years, and it is a great pleasure to welcome him back to the roundtable this morning. Charles Moore, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much.
So this is Volume 2 of your authorized biography of Margaret Thatcher. Was this always going to be a two-volume affair for you?
I hoped it would be, but when I got into this material, there was so much. And since I'm the first person to see the material and therefore to show it to the world, I realized it was too much to handle and it's got to be three volumes. So that's the way it goes.
So this captures the period between 1982 and 1987, and it focuses on Margaret Thatcher's re-election and, of course, her relationship with Ronald Reagan. And I guess it's safe to say this is really the height of her career, isn't it?
Yes, this was both at home and abroad the height of her career. And in the foreign aspect, the relationship with Reagan was central because these two people were very close from way back when they were both out of power, hadn't yet gained power in the 1970s. And they shared an analysis of the world, both about economics and what was wrong with their own countries and about the Soviet Union and the communist threat. So when they both got into office, they really had something to get going on. She got in a bit before he did, and they cooperated. And what you see in the period I'm talking about is when this really comes together in terms of dealing with the Soviet Union, with Mrs. Thatcher actually leading the way a bit there and encouraging President Reagan to come with her.
That leading the way is that she forged a relationship with Mikhail Gorbachev even before he became leader, which then allowed her to help President Reagan overcome his doubts.
That's exactly right. You're spot on. People sometimes forget that Gorbachev wasn't the leader when she asked him over to Britain. But that's very important. She and Reagan had succeeded in restoring Western morale by putting cruise and Pershing missiles into Western Europe to resist Soviet threats. And she thought, well, now we can bargain from strength. And in the book, I tell about this extraordinary meeting at Chequers, her country house, with Gorbachev. When you read it, you think, gosh, this must have been a terrible meeting because they were arguing the whole time. And she was saying free markets and free societies and democracy are good and we have much more opportunity. And he was saying, no, communism's much better. People live joyfully in the Soviet Union. And he used that word and she put an exclamation mark beside it in the minutes, joyfully. And, we have equality. And they were arguing like two clever students. And you'd think, gosh, this is really bad. They're really going hammer and tongs. But the thing was that they found it vigorous and exciting. And they felt they could talk to one another, which had never happened before.
And what's also interesting in the book is how this relationship and how these views have such a profound impact on the rest of the West when it comes to talking to the Soviet Union.
Yes. President Reagan had a big difference with Mrs. Thatcher about where they were really trying to go, because he really was against nuclear missiles. He thought you should rid the world of nuclear missiles because they were so evil. And she thought they are evil, but if your enemy has them, you've got to have them. And it all circulated around the question of the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, which President Reagan wanted, which was trying to get beyond nuclear missiles and have a missile shield. And Mrs. Thatcher did a good job of encouraging President Reagan to go ahead with the research on this missile shield, but not to deploy them without negotiation. And this was the key thing with the Western alliance, because France and Britain and others were terrified that we in Europe would end up with no nuclear defense if Mr. Reagan had his shield. And the Russians, of course, were very so frightened by the idea of SDI that they could have become aggressive in response. And so she was a sort of bridge between the Western allies and President Reagan. And she also interpreted President Reagan to the Soviets, Gorbachev, and vice versa. So people think of her as a very combative lady, but she could be quite diplomatic, and she was quite good at sort of bridging this gap between the two sides, I think because she had such a strong level of personal trust with Reagan.
And she did, you write in the book, she confessed concern about the plan, about Star Wars, to Gorbachev.
She did, which was quite a bold thing to do, because she was sort of saying to Gorbachev, she was confiding in him and saying, you know, I don't actually agree with Reagan about this. And that's a dangerous game, because you're telling your enemy that you don't agree with your ally. But I think she thought that she could take this opportunity to sort of get the communication going between both sides, and she was prepared to take that risk. And it did, in fact, work, because after she'd seen Gorbachev on that Sunday, she went on an amazing sort of world tour, because she had a series of things to do via Beijing, ended up at Camp David at the end of that week, and talked to President Reagan about it all. This is December 1984, and conveyed these messages, and President Reagan agreed with what she was asking for about SDI, and they put out a communique between them that day. And so I think the risk paid off, and he also agreed to that it was a good idea to get closer to Gorbachev, see what was going to change in the Soviet Union, and that risk paid off too.
And we should note she later became a champion of the program.
That's right. I think the Americans did a good bit of flattery on her there, because what they did was they sent General Abrahamson, who was in charge of it all, to see her. And she's not only the first woman prime minister, she's the first prime minister of Britain to have a science degree. And she liked to hear all this technical stuff and feel that she was being consulted and informed about all the details. And I think she was gradually softened up, you know, quite rightly by the Reagan administration from its point of view, to come round to the whole idea.
Charles Moore is our guest. The new book is Margaret Thatcher, At Her Zenith in London, Washington, and Moscow. It is volume 2 of his authorized biography of Margaret Thatcher. The timing of this, we're talking about a time with SDI in 1984. This comes after a pretty severe break in the relationship between Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. You write in the book that they fell out of favor with one another over the U.S. invasion of Grenada.
That's correct. Grenada, a little Caribbean island, Reagan wanted to overthrow the communist coup that had taken place there. But the snag was that Grenada was a former British colony, and the British Queen Elizabeth was still Queen of Grenada, and therefore, it was a sort of insult for the American troops to come in there without agreement. And Mrs. Thatcher was very worried about this and thought and worried about whether it was legal or not. And what upset her most of all was that President Reagan, because I think he knew that she wouldn't like it, didn't tell her about it. He didn't actually fully tell her what he was going to do and when he was going to do it. And she never agreed to it. And this was very upsetting for her, because she had such a close relationship of trust with him. And he telephoned her afterwards and apologized. And in fact, you can hear the tape, because we got it released from the Reagan Library. You can actually hear the tape of this conversation. And it's very funny, really, because it's like a 1940s film with President Reagan as the sort of charming two-timing boyfriend who's making his apologies, and Mrs. Thatcher, the injured girlfriend, who's very cold, and you can really sort of you can literally hear in this tape how that relationship had gone wrong. And there were a few weeks, even a few months, when it was quite a serious threat to the tremendous closeness between the two. But in the end, Mrs. Thatcher saw the sense that this wasn't such an overwhelmingly important issue that it should push everything else aside, and the friendship was restored and rendered effective. And of course, she came and supported Reagan in bad times. For example, Iran-Contra, she didn't get involved with the issue, but she said to the American people, what a great guy Reagan is. And she wrote him a nice letter saying, whatever hurts you hurts America, and whatever hurts America hurts the whole of the free world. So she was very keen to sort of keep bolstering that alliance.
I want to move on to other aspects of her life, but before we leave her relationship with Ronald Reagan, it and you write about this beautifully, of the influence that they had on one another, because arguably they're both at the zeniths of their careers at this point, and they're very, I guess the psychological term is somewhat codependent, aren't they?
Yes. I think Mrs. Thatcher was very useful to President Reagan within his own administration, because he could sort of deploy her support to suppress the strong differences that were within the administration. And somebody like George Shultz, the Secretary of State, who was trying to produce a policy of more nuclear disarmament, could invoke Mrs. Thatcher against the hawks, because she herself was reckoned to be a hawk. Do you see what I mean? So, and the argument was, well, if good old Margaret, I think General Colin Powell said this to me, because he was in the administration at the time, if good old Margaret is saying this, we better pay attention. And of course, the other way round, back in Europe, President Reagan's closeness to Mrs. Thatcher was a great advantage to her in all the sort of councils of Europe, and something that the others envied. I also think it was a temperamental codependence, because she was very active, very detailed, very fierce, always in a hurry. And President Reagan was sort of laid back, relaxed, genial, preferred the big picture. And those two things complemented one another.
Okay, so let's get gossipy for a moment and talk about her relationship with the Queen, which is, as you say in the book, paralyzingly correct.
Yes. There's a lot of films and plays in London in recent years which depict this, and they are wrong, because they show Mrs. Thatcher lecturing the Queen. That's what they think would be fun to show, but it's not right. The problem was what you've just mentioned, which is that Mrs. Thatcher was a bit in awe of the Queen, I think partly for sort of class reasons, and things like being the only woman, wondering what to wear in her presence and that sort of thing. And so their conversations were entirely courteous and useful in a formal constitutional sense, but they couldn't establish a sort of closeness. And this was uneasy for both of them, I think. And when the Prime Minister goes to stay once a year at Balmoral, the Queen's Scottish castle, the Queen likes to give a little supper when they go up the glen and they go into a little hut. It's all very informal. And it's a big pleasure for the Queen on this occasion to do the washing up, because she doesn't get to do that a lot with, back in her palace. Mrs. Thatcher, being a housewife herself, couldn't bear to watch her sovereign do the washing up and she just sitting there not helping. So she would get up and try to help, and this would annoy the Queen very much. So I think there was a little bit of a problem about two women in a man's world not used to working with women. However, the respect was very great, and the best symptom of that is the fact that when Mrs. Thatcher died, the Queen came to her funeral, and the only other Prime Minister of all her 12 Prime Ministers to whose funeral she went was her first one, Winston Churchill. So the fact that she's gone to Churchill and Thatcher and none of the others shows the importance and the status.
You talk about her dealings in a man's world, Mrs. Thatcher's dealings. And the phrase, everyone's mother in a bad temper, who said that about her?
That was one of her officials writing when he left office. He was writing about what it had been like. And I think one of the keys to understanding Mrs. Thatcher as a top politician was, how did the men around her react? And because they almost all were men. And essentially, if men didn't really like a woman or didn't like taking orders from a woman or didn't know how to talk to a woman in these sort of circumstances, they did really badly. And if they did know and or they did like it, they did very well. And so in that way, it was a bit like a court. You know, it was a bit like the court of Queen Elizabeth I in the Tudor times. Some of her colleagues, cabinet colleagues, they came from a generation where, of course, they weren't used to this and they didn't like it. But others of them did, because they found it very stimulating. And Mrs. Thatcher herself was very stimulated by the opposite sex. She was a very correct lady, said there was no question of naughty behaviour, but she was quite flirtatious, and she enjoyed being with intelligent men, particularly well-dressed men, particularly military men. And I think one of the reasons that she kept going so long in office was that she actually loved it. Every time she got up in the morning, she thinks, great, I'm going to be able to go in and dominate all these brilliant men and hear what they say. And you can see that, too, in her relations with world leaders. So she liked Reagan and she liked Gorbachev and she liked François Mitterrand, partly because they were all charming to her as a woman. She would say that. And she didn't like one or two of the others who weren't, like Helmut Kohl, the German chancellor.
We're talking to Charles Moore. He's the author of Margaret Thatcher at Her Zenith. It's the second in the authorized biography of Margaret Thatcher, the second volume. She's at her zenith. She's at the height of her power. And meanwhile, there is trouble at home. She's also a mom. And she has difficulties with her son, Mark, who ultimately ends up going to Dallas, Texas in 1984, and continues to cause his mother quite a deal of problems, both in England and even here in the United States.
That's right. He was sort of exiled, you could say, because some of his business dealings had brought the accusation that he was exploiting his mother's position. And Mrs. Thatcher was not good at dealing with this. She didn't want to make life difficult for Mark, and she didn't know how to handle this situation. And I think I show in the book that on one occasion she probably did act improperly in encouraging a contract that Mark was trying to get with Oman. He went to Dallas, as you say, and there's a hilarious series of memos that went within the British administrative system, because basically there was a question of Mark's security and who was paying for it and how great it was going to be. And Mark seems to have annoyed his hosts a lot down there in Dallas. And one poor official writes something like, "He's a very difficult man to he's a very difficult man to handle," something like that. And another time he says, "I think if he stays much longer in this place, there's going to be a non-terrorist explosion." And and it was a vulnerability of Mrs. Thatcher, because she felt guilty as a mother that she hadn't done enough for her children, and she just, it's quite a paradox that this very, very strong woman was really quite weak and confused about how to deal with problems within the family.
As I mentioned, this particular volume captures the period between 1982 and 1987. Why was 1987 a natural place to end this particular volume?
Well, that's her third and final election victory, when, slightly contrary to expectation, she wiped the floor with the Labour opposition and had a majority of 100. One of the things that's very important to understand about Mrs. Thatcher and her way of thinking about herself was she was never beaten in a general election. She won all the three general elections that she contested. And so she could claim, which was unparalleled, and so she could claim, why do my colleagues want to get rid of me, which they were to do in 1990. How could I have done more of what they wanted? I won everything they wanted me to win.
At the end of this time, and how do we see this change, giving us a glimpse into Volume 3 of how those fortunes change?
Well, from 87, she had about another good 18 months, maybe even 2 years, but gradually the clouds darkened. She introduced the poll tax, which is a particular tax in England, in Britain, that became very unpopular. She fell out with European colleagues about the future of the European community, which she thought was going too far too fast. She fell out with colleagues at home who, I think, really, when you get down to it, were simply fed up with having her around for so long, because she set a terrible pace and she was pretty rude to them. And I think it was time passing, I think they thought, it's time for us. And gradually these things start to accumulate. She was enormous world standing at this time and had a hugely successful visit to Poland and Soviet Union and so on. But gradually at home, things were coming a little bit unstuck, and that became very, very apparent, and indeed it became fatal in 1990. But that's the completion of the story, which you'll have to wait for.
And I know we talked about this the last time you were on, but as we wrap up, the fact that this is an authorized biography, the deal was made that this would not be published until after her death. How was it authorized, and what influence did she have in the information that you got?
Well, she authorized it. It was entirely her idea. And the deal was not only that, as you say, that it couldn't appear until after her death, but that she should not be allowed to read it in her lifetime, because she understood that if she were, people would think she'd been trying to control it. So this was a really key point about the objectivity of the work. And I must say, I thought that despite this contract, she might be difficult and that she might want to try and read it or try to tell me what to say. But I was, because she's not known to be a quiet, uninterfering lady, but actually she was as good as gold, and she literally never told me to say anything, asked me what I was going to say, nothing. And though she had a great ego, I don't think she had a sort of male vanity about what people were going to say about her. I just actually think she didn't care. And she just let me get on with this, and I can't tell you how good that was.
The new volume is Margaret Thatcher at Her Zenith in London, Washington, and Moscow. It is published by Knopf. It's the authorized biography. Charles Moore is the author. Sir, I hope you will come back and talk to us about Volume 3.
Thank you, Joe. I'd love to do that.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you. Bye.
Again, Charles Moore is the author of Margaret Thatcher at Her Zenith. It is published by Knopf. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.